been exactly 6 weeks since a Wayne County woman went missing. Jeanette Ciaramella vanished from the home she shared with her boyfriend in Clyde on November 27th.
A disappearance, the sergeant tells me, is now considered to be suspicious.
And what officers in charge of the case think happened to her?
Somebody has to know something. Somebody just needs to come forward.
The smallest detail could be what it takes to blow this case open.
On November 27th, 2018, 31-year-old Jeanette Ciaramella disappeared from her home in the small town of Clyde in upstate New York. She had no vehicle, no phone, no wallet, and not a single person living nearby in her quiet and friendly neighborhood witnessed her coming or going. Three years have passed since that day, but the investigation seems to have hit a dead end, with no updates from law enforcement on whether they are any closer to finding her than they were on the day she went missing. It's as if she vanished into thin air. But while it may seem that way on the surface, a trace can always be found if the investigation digs deep enough. Someone must know something, right? My name is Amanda Vreeland, host of Unconvicted. This is the investigation into the disappearance of Jeanette Ciaramella. Please be aware that this episode contains content that may be alarming or triggering to some listeners. Please check the show notes for more details and resources, and take care of yourself.
We turned like on Ford Street, so right by that Papa's place.
So, still going straight?
If we're going across the bridge, yeah. Should be.
Almost immediately after leaving Marcus's house, I went to check out the area where he told me that he discovered Jeanette's car. I asked my mother-in-law, Barb, to join me because she's lived in Clyde almost all her life and was surely much more familiar with the town than I was. Our trip to the car was short, but I instantly felt so thankful to have her with me because although the town is small, getting to the lot where her car was probably would have been as difficult as finding a needle in a haystack if I were by myself. Not because the area was secured or hidden or anything like that, but because of not being a local to Clyde myself. Marcus gave me directions the old-fashioned way. Go down to landmark so-and-so until you see the mom-and-pop shop so-and-so, and then make a quick right before you hit this locally nicknamed spot behind the big so-and-so. Unfamiliar territory to me, but was translated easily by Barb. So we headed out of the small neighborhood, and she directed our route.
Is that the street you're talking about?
Yeah, you would turn right there.
Okay.
So there's the fire station. Police station's right there.
We went over the Clyde Bridge that sits right over the Erie Canal. As soon as the bridge ends, the main street of town begins. Barb pointed to the left, commenting to me that the Clyde Police Station was just down that road there, but told me to keep straight because the area Marcus was talking about wasn't actually the police station itself. It was an area behind the fire station that the police use for various things like parking their squad cars, holding inventory, and even for hosting a few local events run by the department. This area is known to the locals of Clyde as the Fire Hall.
Marcus said her car was just in their like back lot by the fire station.
We passed through the old town just a few more blocks until she gave me direction to turn right on Ford Street. That street led us to the fire station, so we pulled around back, and sure enough, we found ourselves on a dirt lot, looking at a large, wire-fenced-in area just ahead, with a light blue, beaten-up Honda Civic parked right at the gated entrance.
Okay, so we're pulled into the lot right now, and yep, there's the car, just like Marcus said.
It sat facing out, and we both took quick note of the fact that it had a Colorado license plate on the front tag. Kind of strange.
And the front bumper is dented. And it's just right out here open and in plain sight. So, yeah. Yeah, that's super weird.
We didn't stay long, though. I snapped a few pictures and we made our way back. I was pretty eager to sit down and compile all of this info as soon as I could so that I could try reaching out to Clyde PD while we were still in New York.
Did you guys find it?
Yeah.
Jeez, where was it?
The dirt lot. And it was in that back fenced area, which is where he said it would be. He said that's where they park some of their like squad cars and stuff. But I mean, it was literally just behind a chain link fence.
I also wanted to try connecting with the older gentleman that Marcus talked about, who had plans with Jeanette on the day she disappeared. And maybe even her friends and family. My mental list of next steps was growing, just as my remaining time in New York was shrinking. I knew for sure, though, especially after learning more from Marcus, that something needed to be done to get this case some recognition, and my work would not come to an end after leaving New York. This was only the beginning. I first tried connecting with the older gentleman that had plans with Jeanette on the day she vanished, but unfortunately came to the realization that getting in contact with him and many of the people I was interested in speaking with would prove to be much more challenging than I initially expected. Social media is often taken for granted in our world today. It's become so easy to Google search someone with just their first and last name and get a plethora of results about them. You can learn their personal details, their professional background, see their social media accounts, photos, political preferences, financial status, and more. However, and it may just be coincidentally, I found that strategy to be far less effective with almost every source I try to connect with, living in and around this cluster of small towns and villages. While that search continued, I decided to reach out to someone I had contact info for, law enforcement. I reached out to Clyde PD twice during my trip there, but was passed around a bit to a few officers that weren't sure who to connect me with for Jeanette's case at that time, due to it being collaboratively managed with the Wayne County Sheriff's Office. So I wasn't able to connect with anyone leading her investigation while I was still physically in New York. After leaving, I reached out again a few more times and was eventually directed to contact a man named Barry Virts with the Wayne County Sheriff's Department. At the time, he was the chief sheriff there. I called and left a message for him in late December of 2019, but never received a call back. Not to call it entirely excusable, but that time period can likely be recalled as uneasy and chaotic for just about everyone, even for many of you listening. In December of 2019, the world was prepping to welcome the new year of 2020 with exciting resolutions and hope for good things to come when the pandemic of COVID-19 hit and changed everything for all of us. No matter where you stood, you probably felt some of the devastation of its force, or at least bared witness to the cracks it made while surging through the foundations of community, business, politics, and health. It was a fearful, stressful, confusing time for all of us for many reasons. The thought of how it could have potentially impacted many cases of those who were missing, murdered, abused, even those that occurred before the pandemic, scares me just as much. One of my best friends was living in Michigan during this time, and someone very close to her went missing and was later found to have been murdered. She remains extremely close to the family of that friend, and I remember her telling me all of the ways she observed it to be clear how COVID was negatively impacting law enforcement's investigation into her friend's murder. Police were swamped over their heads. The process was much harder. Every lead took longer to chase, and crucial aspects of building the case were missed. All I can do is hope that when the time is right, the investigations continue at the pace needed to bring justice to all those who desperately deserve it, including Jeanette. I did, as you can assume, eventually get connected with the Wayne County Sheriff's Office about Jeanette's case, and there is much to come on what has been discussed with them. But before going on, I want to take a moment to outline how the information I have learned about Jeanette's case during my investigation is being released in this podcast. The way that seemed most logical to me was to follow a structure of sharing the things I've learned and relaying my discussions with sources in chronological order of how I actually came about them during this journey, so that you understand what I knew when I knew it, and likely have the same questions at the same times that I did. So, following that timeline, the next step I took in my investigation after the roadblock of not being able to get in contact with law enforcement overseeing her case was to reach out to the other people close to Jeanette, especially those close to her around the time she went missing. In February of 2020, I found who I believed to be Jeanette's mother, Deborah, on Facebook, and sent her a message to see if she'd be willing to speak with me. A week or so went by with no response, so I dug around a bit more and found a few potential email addresses for her and sent messages to those as well. While I was waiting to hopefully hear back, I tried to do some research into Jeanette's history and life growing up in New York. More specifically, I was really looking to see if I could find anything further about what Marcus had mentioned before to me and the media about whatever it was in her past she was trying to run from. In my search, I found an article on an old newspaper archive database from the Sun and Record, a major newspaper company in Williamson, New York, from February 2005, detailing an arrest made of three individuals for charges related to speeding and driving under the influence. The report states that deputies had made attempts to stop a speeding vehicle on Route 104 in the town of Sodus until the car made a quick turn to park in a driveway. That's when four of the subjects in the vehicle suddenly fled the scene on foot. Officers followed and ended up having help from a canine unit to find and arrest two of the people who fled, Michael J. Bean, 17, and Jeanette Sierramella, also listed as being 17 and the driver of the vehicle in this report. They also arrested another person, Joseph R.J. Griffith, listed as 19, who was found passed out in the vehicle. The charges given to them all included unlawful possession and consumption of an alcoholic beverage. But one detail about Jeanette's charges that differed from the rest is that she was also cited for driving in violation of restrictions, which might not seem important now, but I want you to remember it, because it will be important to remember for a later episode. Even though this article wasn't positive for Jeanette, it still definitely didn't seem like something dark or dangerous to be running from, like I was expecting to find. Just as I was about to dive in further, my Facebook Messenger went off with a notification. Deborah had responded.
Part of me hopes that she just ran away to hide, but I know that's not true. If she did, she would have contacted her mother or daughter.
Marcus had stated it was hard for him to believe Jeanette could have ever truly left on her own accord. He just couldn't fathom that being true without her ever at least reaching out to her mom or her daughter to let them know she was okay. I even asked him how sure he was that there was no chance that she had ever reached out to them after going missing.
And you're sure she hasn't done that?
I know for a fact. I talked to them, like, at least once or twice a month. They come over and just randomly just talk to make sure I'm okay. They're good people.
When Deborah responded, I asked if she had a chance to consider speaking with me about her daughter's disappearance, and she let me know that she was beyond ready. She explained further that she didn't feel that Clyde PD had done right by Jeanette, and by the time it was turned over to Wayne County, it was too late. We exchanged a few more messages back and forth and agreed to talk over the phone later that week. However, when the time came for us to speak, she went unresponsive. I've since made numerous attempts to try reconnecting with her, but unfortunately have not yet been successful. Deborah, if you are listening to this now, please reconsider speaking with me for the sake of making every effort possible towards putting the pieces back together of your daughter's puzzle. It's been too long with no answers, and you agreed. I just want to help bring the truth to light for you and for your family. After losing contact with Jeanette's mother, I did a bit more research into Jeanette's past, which quickly gave me an indication on who I should be reaching out to next. When speaking with Marcus, he had made a few references to Jeanette's ex-husband, and I learned that his name is Kevin Scarborough. I already knew that I needed to reach out to him, but one thing that instantly caught my attention in my research was that I was only ever able to find his and Jeanette's marriage license, which was posted to a news source in Tennessee called the Chattanoogan in September of 2014. I couldn't find anything in any state for a recorded divorce. This had me questioning because I didn't get the sense that Marcus was aware or not of this, but was he really an ex-husband or were they actually still married? It took me a while to finally get in contact with him, but I was eventually able to connect with Kevin Scarborough in November of 2021, actually just a few days shy of the official 3-year mark of her disappearance. We communicated over Messenger for a while before being able to chat on the phone, and Kevin agreed to let me share our conversation for the podcast. When I reached out asking if he would consider speaking with me, he got straight to the point. Just a word of caution, some of what we discussed may be difficult to hear and may also be triggering for some. Here is a portion of our conversation over Messenger before we were able to speak on the phone.
She was my wife, and we were together for 13 years. Long story short, she left me in Tennessee and went home to New York to cheat with her high school boyfriend, and it was 8 months before I moved here in 2017 to try to fix things and more importantly be in my daughter's life, who was 4 at the time. I soon found out she was shooting heroin and running around with all kinds of different men, from junkies to big-time drug dealers. She was living with a guy named Marcus Lee, who reported her missing. She hasn't been seen or heard of since, with searches by multiple police departments done to no avail. My daughter gets picked on at school, and we are still in the process of moving on from that. It's not something I like to dig up, but that is most of what I know. I hope that helps you in any way.
I then thanked him for the quick response, and I asked if he would share how he came to learn that Jeanette was being unfaithful and about the drug activity.
Well, she told me her mom was sick and may pass away, and that she had to go to New York to be with her. Well, her mom called me about 2 weeks after she left, telling me she was having men in and out of her house, drinking and doing drugs, in which I asked about her sickness, and she said she was never sick and that it was all a lie. Then, when I moved up here to New York to work on things, I caught her lying about where she was several times. Then it all made sense when I found used needles in our bathroom closet, and when I confronted her, she of course lied and said they weren't hers, and she was disposing them for someone. Then I found a plate with a spoon and stuff also. I put the needles in a baggie and called the cops, and they said they couldn't do anything because there was no way to prove they were hers. I called her brother and mother and told them she needed help, but they did nothing. I have to stay in her hometown because Jeanette's mother took me to court for visitation of my daughter and had her taken from me until I won custody back, fighting in court and going in debt with lawyers. The panic attacks I had from constantly worrying about something happening to my daughter. I can't even pump gas without thinking someone is going to take her. I never let her go anywhere because I don't trust anyone to look out for her. I'm always watching my back wondering, is the person that did it coming after us, or did she just run away? Or thousands of other scenarios in my head every day. How every time they say a person has been found or a body has been found, I dig online for hours thinking it could be her, or if I see a woman walking down the road thinking it could be her. Fear of sleeping at night, and I was always a very confident man, never afraid of anything. I just let my daughter stay the night 2 trailers down a couple of months ago, and she couldn't even stay because she was crying and wanting me at bedtime. But then I realized I'm ruining her life and teaching her to live in fear, and she isn't having a real childhood. So I have forced her to have sleepovers. Every night when we say prayers at bedtime, my daughter is asking God to make it rain tomorrow or something to give her a sign that her mommy is okay or that she will come back. These fears I had somehow managed to quiet have been much louder since you messaged me. But I would do anything to bring any type of justice or closure to me and for my daughter. I am actually still legally married and cannot move on because no one knows where she is to serve her, so the courts say I can't do anything until she has been missing for 5 years. This has all been like a bad movie that just won't end. It's just been surreal.
I've managed to stay as objective as possible throughout all my discussions with sources for this case. But I'll admit, it's not always easy in the moment. This conversation with Kevin was very much one of those times. The person I expected to hear from, especially after Marcus shared his opinions towards Kevin's character, was monstrous and indifferent to the feelings of his daughter, but this was not the impression I got from those heartbreaking words. I say this just to remind everyone listening that being human is what makes cases like these so hard. It's easy to play detective and make up the details of someone's real life in your head or to others while hiding behind a keyboard, but it's not as easy to do that after you've actually connected with them and let them share their story, because as humans, it's in our nature to relate and sympathize. So try as I have, as I move forward in sharing my discussions with Marcus, Kevin, and many others, to hone in on the details and suppress quick judgments, because remember, this case is not yet solved. Jeanette and Kevin got married in 2014 and had a daughter together that they named Lila. They all lived together in Tennessee. I remember Marcus mentioning that Jeanette moved away from New York after high school to join the Army, so I assumed at the time that something related to those duties were probably what brought her to Tennessee in some way. Although it seems clear that Kevin and Marcus don't exactly see eye to eye for a handful of reasons, they both unknowingly had a lot of the same things to say about certain aspects of Jeanette's disappearance.
What I don't get is how they haven't found a body, so it doesn't, I don't know. So sometimes I think she ran off, then sometimes I think somebody did something to her, then sometimes I think that she gets sold into sex, the sex trade or sex slave or whatever they call that crap, or I don't know. I've been in and out of this over and over and over. I still, like I said, here just a while ago, maybe 4 or 5 months ago, I go to Chimney Bluffs out here at a certain spot and hang out by myself and kind of read and whatnot. And the police were there searching. Anytime there's a body found, I'm always constantly digging on the internet. Is she found? Jeanette Sierra Mellon, it's all in my history.
I asked Kevin if he thought it was possible that Jeanette left by her own choice.
With our daughter, she wouldn't. That's the only thing that makes me think something bad has happened, because she wouldn't just leave Lila like that. She took Lila when she left me to even come up here and run around and be crazy. She had Lila in the car when she passed out behind the wheel and wrecked because she was overdosing on heroin. Like, she took that kid everywhere, even to the bad places, but she loved her daughter. Like, she wouldn't just abandon her daughter and not fight to get back.
Yeah, here's the thing, is that somebody somewhere knows something.
Absolutely.
She didn't just go not say anything to anybody and just run off by herself and create a new life. You know what I'm saying? Somebody knows some information somewhere, and it's bad enough to where they don't want to say it.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where, honestly, like I said, I feel like I've been talking awfully loud, but I hope my daughter hasn't heard me. But I tell my daughter a lot that she just, you know, she's living another life. She didn't want the responsibility or whatnot. I don't really know what to tell her, but I'm not going to tell her that she's passed when I don't know for sure. But every night she still prays for her mom at bedtime. It's tough. And like I said, I had slowly started letting, I've been so protective of Lila and just watching my back everywhere. And I had a bad anxiety attack where I just, my whole body locked up and I had to go to a doctor, and it's been crazy. Then I finally had to realize, like, I've got my grip so heavy on my daughter that I'm not letting her have friends. I'm not letting her go stay the night anywhere. And so been getting a little better, and I'm not blaming you by any means. I appreciate you doing whatever work you're trying to do and, you know, anything that anybody's doing. But since we talked again, it's like, it's all come back. Yeah, I hadn't slept. Like, I'm just sitting here thinking again, like, scenarios. And
I asked Kevin to explain further how or why Jeanette made the decision to move back to New York from their life in Tennessee.
Listen, Jeanette was very smart, okay? She, or, you know, she thought she was, or whatever, but she told me that her mom was sick and was going to die and had to come to New York, and all she did was come up here and run around with Josh Byron or Brian or whatever his name is.
Is that the high school boyfriend?
Yes, okay. As far as I know. And then the mother called me, the grandma, Jeanette's mom called me like, hey, she's running around up here, got Josh in and out of the house. She's running around like she's 15. She's drinking and doing drugs. And I'm like, well, aren't you sick? Because I had just lost my mom like a year ago. That's why I was like, nah, it's cool. Go, you do your mom.
Was her daughter living with Marcus when she moved in with him?
I think so. She was so back and forth. She was at my house sometimes, but she was mainly with Marcus. And they had pictures and my daughter and blah, blah, blah. But I think that my daughter was with the grandmother as far as I know. I know that the grandmother ended up with, so Jeanette's mom ended up like having Lila and going to court and saying all this bull crap about me and getting emergency temporary custody and then dragging me through court, and I had to go fight for custody for my daughter and win full custody back. So as far as I know, Jeanette had dropped Lila off with the grandmother, but Marcus could have had her, I guess, maybe been watching her and then took her to the grandmother. I don't know.
Yeah, from what I spoke with him, it definitely sounds like he, you know, maybe he just didn't mention it, but it didn't seem at all like he knew about the multiple guys situation. Because, yeah. I mean, from his perspective, they were in a pretty serious relationship.
Kevin explained that he became aware of Jeanette being involved with a few men when she returned to New York. From his perspective, Marcus was just one of those. But that didn't seem like something Marcus knew about from my conversation with him. The drug activity also didn't seem to be something that Marcus knew of as being an active problem that was out of control, at least at the time of her disappearance. But it's hard to say. Relapse can be tricky like that. I asked Kevin what he thought about Marcus's claim that Jeanette told him she was really just trying to help people out of that lifestyle.
I was in Tennessee for 8 months before I finally was able to pack everything up and move up here. And they said that she's been a well-known heroin addict. They knew it. So either he's fooling you or he was truly ignorant to the fact of what she was really doing. Because she had no vehicle. He would give her money, let her drive his truck wherever. So that makes a lot of sense that that would be what she would be telling him to be able to get her ride and get her money to go, quote unquote, help people. But she was using fully the whole time. No, she clearly told me later on that she was lying about that. Like, I didn't know. She told me she had a problem. Once I found those, and then I found the spoon and the plate underneath the, like I said, when I found the needles, I found like 6 needles or something. I kept finding them in random hidden places. I called the cops and I was like, look, man, she's like, she needs help. I was like, here's the needles. I had them all saved in a bag. I had my son there with me that was, I think, 15 or so at the time. And they pretty much looked at me and said, sir, those could be your needles for all we know. And I'm like, yeah, that's what I did, dude. So then that's when I called the family and I was like, listen, man, she's like, I ain't gonna sit here and say I've never done no drugs or whatever, but she's shooting dope in her blood system. I've seen this, like, people don't come back. She needs help. And nobody, I figured her immediate family, there's a thing, like, where if there's 4 or 5 of y'all, closest family, y'all can sign her up into a rehab and forcibly put her into help and this and that. Nobody, it's like, nobody cared to do nothing. The more that I've thought about this, like, I mean, obviously, I've got my daughter. We talk, you know, she cries about this. Kids at school say, hey, your mom, like, I hear, trust, it's crazy. But out of all of it, I think Marcus genuinely cared about Jeanette, and I don't think he really had any, I think he really didn't have anything to do with it, but as much as I don't like Marcus, I would like to know, why wouldn't he, you know, who are these bad people that she was talking about? I heard the same thing. I've looked up his story and everything that he said 100 times, and it's like, you know, did she never say any names or him go through her phone or, like, find any kind of information on who these bad people? I mean, it's a small town. It ain't like it's a big city and hard to find people or whatever.
The way that she had explained it to him when he found those messages was, yeah, he just won't leave me alone. He's harassing me. He's making death threats. Like, I need to get
this. When you block a phone number or you get an order of protection, it's actually like.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? So did Marcus ever tell you about the times that he would physically hold her and restrain her and hold her down at the house while she called? And I could hear everything going on the other side of the phone that he mentioned that he would try to keep her at the house. Right, but I mean, so she used to call me and like throw the phone down pretty much, and I would hear like, Marcus, let me go, and him struggling with her. But at the same time, like, I know he is very smart, and he very well could have been like, you're not going to go use drugs. That's and trying to keep her from leaving to go to a bad place or something. I don't know. I've been in and out of all these scenarios, but.
And that is the reason Marcus gave me for why it was that he threw and broke Jeanette's phone when he did. So I asked Kevin what he knew about those bad people, specifically Elijah Jenkins and the group of people that associated with him.
The cops, they come to, which I worked with detectives and gave them everything. I gave them my phone. I gave them everything. Talked to them. They would pop in at 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, whenever they wanted to. I'd have them in the house and talk to them. And they were trying to convince me to set up a fake drug deal, and have him come to the house and wear, you know, recording devices, all this and that. And as much as I wanted to do that, all I could think about was my kids and like, this guy's going to know where I live at. This guy's going to know who I am. You know, like
the police were trying to set this up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just told them I couldn't put my kids in danger any more than they already are.
Yeah.
But I guess they got their chance when they got the dude for kidnapping. And I thought that was going to be it. I thought they were going to find something, but still no avail.
I then told him about Marcus finding Jeanette's car in Clyde PD's lot after the property search on Bloom Road.
One thing that he made note of while I was there, actually, he said that after the search happened at that property and police had told him that they didn't find anything, he said that the car that she had apparently showed up out of nowhere in their back lot. And he told me where to go look for it and everything. So we did actually end up driving by and we did see it.
Who's back lot?
Clyde PD.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's odd. Yeah, that's even deep. I mean, trust me, I've thought that route too, because she had a lot of run-ins with cops and would get away with, she would have drugs on her and everything and get to go home.
Kevin made a point to let me know during our discussion that he actually reached out to investigators again after I contacted him for an interview, just to keep them informed. Which is smart, and also makes a strong case to show just how much he watches over his back now as a result of Jeanette's disappearance. I asked what his communication level has been with them throughout all of this, especially since I was still not having any luck.
But what was odd too is when I called him, I'm like, okay, because like I said, anybody that's reached out to me, it was nothing against you, but the cops really surprised me because I was working with one detective, and then that guy said he was getting off the case or something. He had to do something else, and he introduced me to a female detective, a blonde-headed lady, and she spoke with me for the most of the time after that. And then when I called them back, I was thinking the dispatch lady was like, let me try to find the investigator that had the case, and she asked me all this information. I gave it all to her, and it took like an hour for him to call me back. And when they called me back, I'm telling this guy all this stuff, and he's like, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not the guy that was on the case. We don't know who really was leading that investigation.
That's the same response that I've gotten.
There should be records, like police files, that show who was leading the investigation. No, they don't care one bit. They seemed, once that they did get involved, they did their thing once they got involved. It's just that, you know, I think if I want to give them any kind of, you know, good side to this or however you would say it, I think they knew that she was a drug user. And I think, like, okay, we know Jeanette. She's been missed. They pulled her over several times, brought her to the hospital. They said that they had pictures of she was a user. So maybe they thought like, okay, she's missing. She, you know, whatever. It's just another user. She's out on a bender or something. And then when it became a month, 2 months, they were like, okay, maybe we need, you know what I mean? And maybe yeah. that's why they kind of didn't jump or whatever. Cause it really, and this is a terrible thing to say, but it really ups, I shouldn't say that, but I guess it is what it is. It bugs me when I see someone go missing and then 2 or 3 days later they find this person because they did a search for them. And I'm like, I'm glad that person was returned to their family. I'm not saying I wish like something bad. That's not what I'm saying, but it's like, okay, why didn't y'all do that with her?
I then relayed to Kevin the timeline of events that Marcus had described to me about the day Jeanette went missing, and specifically asked what he knew about that day and about the older gentleman that Jeanette was planning to help out that morning. A quick note here, though. You might remember that I had referred to this gentleman by the name of Nick for privacy reasons, because I had not yet at that time been able to establish a connection with him. Since then, though, I have. And don't worry, you will be hearing from him in a future episode. So, as he has agreed to let me share his name, you're about to hear him discussed in my conversation with Kevin. His name is Neil Fuller.
Is his name Neil? Last name Fuller?
He didn't actually give me a name, but he said he was an older gentleman. And
yeah, so that's our freaking neighbor, old nasty freaking fat dude that used to, sorry, this guy was literally, so I lived on Buchanan Road, 11692, I think, Buchanan Road in Wolcott. This dude lived directly across the street. His name was Neil Fuller. He's an old, he used to be a town judge, so he's got a lot of pull and all this and that. And she was always over there. She showed me messages where he was calling her crying, saying, I love you and all this and that. And she would go, he was like diabetic or something. So she'd go over there and give him shots.
Yeah, that's what he said too.
Yeah, so I came home one day. I'm from the South. I'm a very protective person. So I come home one day, Jeanette's walking across from his house with an envelope in her hand. So, this is after I already knew she was doing drugs and all this and that, and was like I started doing things like coming home early from work. Hey, babe, where you at? Oh, I'm here cleaning the house or whatever. Show up while I'm on the phone with her. Oh, you are? Because I'm in our, you know, started finding her doing all this sneaky stuff. And, so I kind of acted cool, snatched the envelope out of her hand, ran to the bathroom, locked the door, opened it up, and it's a whole bunch of like Xanaxes and hydrocodones. So he was mowing his yard, so I went over there. He's an older gentleman. He's like, I don't know, at the time he had to be like 60-something. I didn't want to hurt the guy, but I went on his property. I had a few choice words, and I told him I'd kill him if he ever gave Jeanette any kind of drugs again. And he threatened to pull a gun on me and told me to get off his property and try to come over later and talk things out. But the cops looked into him, too. They took his phone. And he was real weird, man. He would come by the house. He's like, hey, if the cops come by here, don't say anything past tense, like she was alive or anything that, like, he was trying to give me advice, and I'm like, dude, I have nothing, like, what are you trying, it's like you're prepping me for something I'm lying about, like, I have nothing to hide with, because he's seen the cop, he's questionable too, man. She was around such dumb company, and was around so many weird men, and she was a pretty girl, and she was crafty, and she used Neil's truck all the time, she used Marcus's truck, she used my stuff, she told the Ford Focus that I had paid off, I turned around and bought her that little blue Honda for $6,000 cash. She knew how to play people left and freaking right, make everybody think that she loved them, and I mean, she was very smart. She was a very smart lady.
Did he confirm, or did he ever, like, just pony up and be honest about giving those drugs to her, or do you think maybe she could have stolen them from him?
No, she definitely didn't steal them from him. He was giving her whatever she wanted, because he's a heavier old man that was a widower. His wife had passed away in a bike wreck. He was driving the bike, and they got in a wreck, and his wife died. He didn't. And so I think Jeanette used that, you know, kind of relationship type thing with him. But I mean, as far as what you're asking though, for 100%, I couldn't tell you that she didn't steal them from him. But in my heart of hearts, I feel like he was giving her, she would always be driving his little red truck, always have money. He would bring my daughter stuffed animals over with, I love you. It was just weird. It was just a whole weird situation. That's where things get deep. And I, like I said, I don't want no trouble from nobody, but that dude, he had a lot of he was an old town judge. He was friends with a lot of cops and whatnot. You know what I'm saying? So,
yeah.
I asked Kevin to give me a description of Jeanette's car so that I could reference back to the pictures I took of it that day, just to be sure it really was hers. His description, just like Marcus's, was spot on.
It is definitely her car.
Okay, so you're saying it?
Yeah, what you just described is that's absolutely her car.
Yeah. And it's in the police. I wonder, see, man, I'm going to get pissed off all over again.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's okay. It just makes me want to go down there and, like, ask them what the, you know, what in the world, why was it? Because that's my car. I paid for that car. Like, and then that's part of the investigation. Like, why wasn't it said we found her vehicle at so-and-so address or wherever they found it at? That doesn't...
I wonder if they maybe told Jeanette's mom. I wonder if they have told Jeanette's mom. And I was wondering if potentially they had let her know, just because of her being family, that they had found it. Because usually from what I've seen, that's how police will operate. If there are any details like that, that they need to let the family know without making public because of the, you know, to make sure that the investigation stays tight while they're doing it, it'll usually be just family. But do you think that would probably have been something that her mom would have relayed to you?
Oh, definitely. Sure. It's hard to say with that woman, honestly. She's a tough character, but like I said, I think she deals with a lot of pain and stuff. And, you know, I don't know. I can't, but we've been really good for the past forever, like past year or so. So, you know, like she would have let me know. They all knew that I was concerned.
I asked Kevin what the relationship was between he and Deborah now.
Me and her are pretty much on good terms. She gets Lila every other weekend. She just dropped her off at my house this past Sunday. We're actually pretty good, which I didn't think it would ever get that way, but I'm glad that it is that way, being in Tennessee, where my daughter could be around her uncles and family and stuff, but it's through court order that, you know, she gets every other weekend and whatnot, which is kind of unfair, I think, to me, because I didn't have a child with her, but it's kind of helped me here. But
I
made a great career, found a good job, and found a good woman, and kind of moving on, and then all this kind of stirred right back up again. But like I said, if anything that can help find anything or give any more information, or like I said, I can't even get a divorce. Like I want to get married and move on and kind of close this chapter, but obviously I'm still legally married, and I've paid like $400 to try to get a divorce. They tell me I got to serve her papers, and I'm like how? So I brought all the clippings down. I'm like, I need, you know, yada, yada, yada. It's just been hard all the way around, this whole situation. Like I said, it's like a bad movie that just won't stop.
I told him that I reached out and what she said, and that she went unresponsive.
I never heard any of that or seen any kind of that emotion from any of them. But like I said, Deb too, so I don't know if you know a lot about their family, but Deb lost her husband, which is Jeanette and Alan and Ronnie's dad, obviously, at a young age, and had to raise these kids on her own. So I think she's always been like a pretty cold person, but I don't think, you know, I think she's just been hurt and doesn't really know or want to show emotion or whatnot.
Kevin also explained that someone in the court system during custody hearings between Jeanette's mother and him over Lila had suggested that the three of them, Deborah, Kevin, and Lila, all do grievance counseling together. And Kevin said he thought it would be a good idea, but Jeanette's mother, for some reason, didn't exactly agree.
And I agreed to it, and right in front of the court, she was like, no, we don't need to do that. I know my daughter. I know who killed my daughter and all this. Right in front of the court, we know she's dead or something, blah, blah.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah, yeah, very, very, very wild. And like I said, I'm not speaking ill of anybody, whatever. I'm just telling you some things that stuck out weird to me. So her brother, Alan Sierra Mella, I was messaging him back and forth because I was in this state there for a little bit. Like I said, I was about to go to jail. Like, I was about to start just handling some business. I was talking to Alan,
was like, where's this guy live? Where's this guy at? Where's this? And blah, blah, blah. And he's like, listen, man, Jeanette made her, like, this is her family, and this is fresh, and they're not crying. They're not, he's like, Jeanette made her decisions. And we gotta move on and blah, blah. And it just blew my mind. I've never seen them sad. Maybe they're good at hiding it. Maybe they're not, emotional people or whatnot, but.
Were they close?
Do what?
Were they close?
So, I think so, but I mean, when I met Jeanette, it was down in, Georgia. She was in the military for a long time and didn't really see her family or have a relationship until me and her started talking and my mom got sick and all this and that. Then, I encouraged her to build a relationship back, but as far, I mean, honestly, I guess they really weren't that close, but,
but it's still family.
Well, correct, man. So, you know what I mean? Like, I would have not, I don't know. But like I said, they also tried to use in court the fact that I was texting them saying that I'm going to find so-and-so and I'm going to do something to so-and-so and tried to use that against me. I'm like, okay. Anybody in their right mind, if you thought somebody murdered someone you loved, I would think you weren't okay if you didn't get upset and want to find out or hurt some. I mean, not that I do want to hurt anybody anymore or anything like that, but there was a time where I was like, that's my wife, that's the mother of my kid, no matter what she done to me and took me away, blah, blah. And, but they acted like I was just in the wrong, like my family would have hunted somebody down, man. And
yeah, it almost should have been more concerning that the family and stuff wasn't saying the same things.
Exactly. Like, I felt crazy for a little bit, but I'm like, no, it's not crazy. You're crazy if you don't care. Like, that's what makes you a mental person.
Yeah.
If you don't.
I asked him about how Lila was doing now and how she has handled her mother's disappearance.
Lila says a lot of times, she's like, Daddy, we just got a curse on our family. Something bad like that happened. We're cursed and nothing good is ever going to happen and blah, blah. And I have to tell her that, you know, mommy wasn't making the best decisions. And when we don't make good decisions, not good things happen. So, I mean, I haven't like went out and said in detail about drug use and whatnot, but she knows she was old enough to see the places her mom was taking her and the wreck that she was in and her mom passing out, standing up and hitting her face on the floor. I mean, that girl has seen a lot. So she doesn't quite understand, but I did explain to her, you know, we're not cursed, but when we put ourselves around dangerous people or in bad situations and make bad decisions, you know, there's a bad outcome that could potentially come from that. So I would love nothing more than to ditch this town and go 14 hours back to Chattanooga and not have to watch my back all the time. But yes, it is what it is, and God's got a purpose in it all, and it's all going to be part of my story. So, and see, that's the thing. I've tried, like, even with the mom and Marcus and everybody, all these people involved, I know God's like, forgive your enemies. I've got a prayer wall, and I pray for these people, man. I'm just trying to, you know, obviously it's been 3 years. She ain't made her way back to me or to Lila or to Marcus or whatever, back to the, you know, land of whatever. And so I've just kind of started being like, okay, this is what happened. This is part of my journey, and it's time to face it and move forward, you know.
I then thanked Kevin for speaking with me and let him know I'd keep pushing to talk to investigators.
Well, I said, don't feel bad for reaching out. I appreciate it. But just to know that somebody actually is still caring and thinking about her and trying, you know, that means... that means a lot, so it's all good.
Thank you.
Before we ended our call, he did share one more thing with me that left me with chills. He mentioned that after Jeanette vanished, he received an eerie message from someone he didn't know on Facebook and thought he recalled her name as being Ashlyn. This person messaged Kevin to tell him that she had overheard someone talking about Jeanette's body being disposed of after overdosing on drugs.
So this Ashlyn person, was that her friend?
I honestly have no idea. She kind of reached out to me the way that you did. It was under a message request. I didn't know the girl. She was, I want to say, maybe lived in Sodus area. But I gave the police her information and just kind of, I don't know if I blocked her or whatnot. I could try to look at my blocked people and try to see if she's there.
Did she say why she was bringing it to you? Like, why? What was her motive in telling you that?
Basically, I remember her saying, like, I know this has to be hard on you and you need some kind of closure and blah, blah, blah. And she pretty much said she overheard somebody talking that she had overdosed and somebody got rid of her bike.
Now more than ever, I really needed to get some answers from law enforcement, especially on this, because if what we've all been saying is true, that someone out there really has to know something, and those people are coming forward with that info, it needs to be vetted by investigators.
He was going around telling everybody that he, like, you know, chopped her up and spread her out through the field and threw her in a pond, like, you know.
And obviously, if it was found, you know, prior to us getting involved, we wouldn't have been looking for it at that point.
Sitting here, you know, in hindsight, I was one of the last people probably to see her, you know.
That's next time on Unconvicted. This podcast is actively being produced at the time of its release, which means new information is being added daily. If you know anything regarding the disappearance of Jeanette Sierra Mella, please contact the Wayne County Sheriff's Department at 315-946-9711 or Clyde PD at 315-923-3121. If you have any information relevant to Jeanette's case or the things discussed on this podcast and would like to share for future episodes, you can find links to our social media and contact info in the show notes, as well as photos and links to our sources. Unconvicted is written, recorded, edited, and produced by me, Amanda Vreeland. Thank you for listening.